copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Last year, I think maybe 2 years ago, because I don't do debates unless I have at least a year to prepare for them, I was contacted by a university. Wanted to know if I would debate a particular atheist from a university on the West Coast. But they said, we do not want for people for this debate to be a bloodbath. And the reason they had to say that, unfortunately, is too often that's the case. And so I'm not suggesting that you would be like that, combative, in a debate, but I do find that apologists have a tendency to move in that direction. So maybe this is more of a caution for many of you rather than a corrective, because I think it is maybe a danger for us. So I'm talking about civility and humility in apologetics, two concerning facts facing apologetics, and one of image and not of identity. That would not be true for some of the European countries. I know that some of the European countries, you say apologetics and nobody really knows what you're talking about. But there are many places now that over the years, apologetics has some name recognition, of course, obviously in the United States. But the image is where we're having a great problem. We have an image problem simply because of the things that I will mention. The absence of attitudinal civility. That is, when we are as apologists, and whether we are one-on-one or we're doing maybe a professional debate, the tendency sometimes can be to be a little combative, that we become more interested in winning the argument than we are in the interest of truth. You know, the Bible tells us that we are to speak the truth in love. And that's love for the truth, but it's also love for the human being who's in front of you. And how one treats the other, the humanness of another. I was debating an atheist, of course, that's what I usually do, but I don't do that anymore. But after the debate, a young man came up to me and said, why didn't you really let him have it? You had him on the ropes. And I said, because Jesus wouldn't do that. I said, you knew. Do you think the audience out here are dumb? They saw the point. Why would I embarrass somebody? Why would I treat another person with disrespect just because I disagree with them? And yet here I am talking about a God of love, and I'm treating another human being made in the image of God with disrespect and disregard. So we have to be very careful. The absence of epistemic or epistemological humility, how one views his or her own humanness. I was speaking to a group of students at Washington, well, in D.C., the three major universities there, and that we had gathered, and we were doing Q&A sort of thing, and one young lady stands up and she said, you know what I can't really take about you evangelicals? I was glad she only had one thing. She said, you're so arrogant in your claims. What do you say about that? Guilty as charged. You do not make truth any stronger by shouting in claiming that you are the final authority. So how one views our own humanness, the limits, both I would say in extent and absoluteness, of human knowledge claims. There's a difference between saying something with confidence and claiming absolute epistemological certainty. After all, we're fallen, even if we may be redeemed. And we're also finite. We don't know everything. Well, at least when you get my age, you know you don't know everything. And so it comes across that the only way this situation is going to be resolved is if you cross over my line to my side. Well, there's no conversation at that point. It's, you've got to just say, I'm right and you're wrong, and if we want to get this thing done, you're going to have to cross over to my side. Well, that doesn't open up for much discussion, and I would even argue it doesn't say much about how I treat another person. So I will call this a commitment to virtue apologetics. Now, I have the real privilege of teaching young pastors apologetics. I had to make a commitment when I was going to go into the academy. I've been a pastor for 30 years, started three churches, and I thought, well, when I get 60, I think I would like to go and teach in a seminary. I could have gone to a university, but I'm a churchman, and I just wanted to be training pastors who were going to go out into local churches and have some understanding and appreciation for apologetics. Now, I've been listening to the discussion just before this when you're talking about how to get apologetics introduced into local churches. And one of the most difficult things is to get past, and I say this with all kindness, but to get past the pastor. Because that, if they don't understand or they're not committed to it, it really does make the sledding much more difficult. So I have that great privilege of teaching a number of young men and women, and I try to speak to them and to encourage them to what I would call the virtue apologetic. Now, the Christian is the medium for the message. Now, I'm pretty much committed to Marsha McLuhan, Neil Postman, that says that they would say the message, the medium is the message. I don't know that I would go that far, but I would certainly claim that there is a message in the medium. And in this case, if it's a face-to-face engagement, we are the medium. So how we treat others and how we present ourselves in this discussion, this proclamation of the truth claims of Christianity, if we must do it in a way that is complementary to the message that we are giving. I mean, if you're going to frame a picture, you always try to pick out a frame that complements the picture. Well, it's the same thing here. If we're combative, if we're argumentative, in your face sort of thing, that seems to be somewhat inconsistent with the message that we're trying to share. That is, roughly speaking, how that Christ came into the world to save men and women. So the medium does influence how the message is received. And we've heard this again and again and again. When you start witnessing to unbelievers, they've got a whole list of reasons why it is they don't want to listen to Christians. And one of the reasons is often here. I just don't like. I was talking with a gentleman the other day. We were having a time together. And he said, I remember before I came to Christ, there was a lady that lived on my street. And he said, every time she saw me coming, she would latch onto me like iron on a magnet. And he said she would not let me go, as she just kept berating me and giving me all this information. So he said it got so that after a while, when I would take the dog out for a walk and I saw her coming, I very conveniently got on the other side of the street as quickly as I could, or maybe just simply go in the other direction. Now, that person was well-meaning. I don't have any doubt about that. So I'm not talking about the sincerity of what people do. I'm just talking about whether or not it's the wise thing that we go about this great task. I mean, it's a weighty message that we bring to people. The Bible, so why would we worry about things like humility and civility? I mean, is it just because it would make the task that we're doing go better or something? And I would argue, no, it's because the Bible literally teaches us this. We don't make this assumption or assertion from inference. We aren't just saying, oh, Jesus was meek and mild. We have explicit statements in the Bible, like James 4:6. God opposes the proud. We're not to boast of what we have. Christ is our example. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Colossians chapter 3, verse 12, Paul tells us to put on humility. My assumption is it's not something that comes to us naturally. Pride is a sign of error, according to 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5. Humility, if we're looking for some form of a definition, puts life in proper perspective by recognizing the complexity of life and our limitations. Now, having lived many years and having come to Christ in the last decade, excuse me, the last century. So I'm living through some of the turmoil now in our country that we lived through the 60s in Europe and in America. So I came to Christ when I was 20 years old in 1965. So if you want to calculate my age, that's okay. And in those days, I know how you're excited. Did you just come to Christ? You think everybody wants to come to Christ. This is the greatest news that you have ever heard. And surely, the only reason somebody hasn't trusted Christ is because nobody's told them yet. And so you go at it full force. And I look back on those days, and I think about the zeal. And if there's one thing that concerns me in my own heart today, it's that I fear that the zeal isn't as hot as it once was. And that's a danger as well. But over the years, being a pastor for 30-some years, and just living life, you realize there are very few simple answers to the great questions of life. And if you come off as if you've got the answers for everything, I doubt you recognize the complexity of life and my own limitations. Sometimes I thought I've had the best answer, which proved not to be the best answer. And so, if we are not taught by life to be humble, we just have to live a little bit longer. Then I would speak about epistemological humility. Here is a much larger subject than what we would talk about today. But this idea of what I call attitudinal dogmatism, an epistemological overreach that betrays our finiteness. That is, we make claims with greater sense of absoluteness than we have the right to do. Now, that is not saying that we don't have confidence and assurance in what we have to say, but that we ought to be able to say these things with a measure of what I would call epistemological humility. Often when teaching, I will ask students, how many of you over the last 10 years have changed your belief about something religious? And virtually to a student, every hand goes up. Did you think you were right 5 years ago? Absolutely. But now you think differently. Well, why is that? Well, there's a number of reasons, obviously, that because we are finite, we get more information, more data comes in, we learn from experience, etc. It's just, I'm only trying here to underscore what I would call epistemological humility. And being able to enter into a dialogue with another person and being able to speak with confidence but not overreaching the claims that we can make. And maybe, in fact, it might be helpful if at this point I just stop, because sometimes this is misunderstood. So I'm happy to introduce, to accept questions or a little pushback here on this idea of epistemological humility. What I'm speaking of is how we speak with epistemological humility. I can have complete confidence that I'm right. But for me to say, as I'm in conversation with somebody else, if I don't give opportunity for that person to give their position as well, I won't do that if I lack epistemological humility. If I'm just interested in setting forth, this is the truth, I know it's the truth, and now you have no option but to come to my side. So it is more of an attitude, and I think that's what I'm trying to speak to here. It's an attitude of how do I approach giving the truth claims of Christianity to those about me. That's all I'm asking. Is it possible that I'm wrong? Now, I don't think I'm wrong. That sounds kind of arrogant. But I don't think I'm wrong, and I'm willing to put my life on the line for what I believe. And I'm willing to defend that to this other person. I'm not suggesting we don't do that. I'm suggesting that as we are in the conversation, that we begin the conversation with an openness, not being deceptive, because I have that confidence. But if I begin the conversation, as I think I did many times when I was first became a Christian, and I just said, this is what you've got to do, because it's right. Well, yeah, it may be right, but that beginning does not open up for conversation that I can begin to ask questions of that individual and we can have something to say to one another. That doesn't mean I don't believe it and I'm not being deceptive. What this does is it opens up the individual to have a serious conversation about something that's of extreme importance. And it should be, that person should be able to come to that position, the position that I hold, not because I say it's right, but we've been able to work through, answer the questions, and I think what I call epistemological humility, that's what opens up the possibility for those kind of conversations. We are fallen, we're finite. I think what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13:12, he said, I see through a glass darkly. I confess I do. There are times when I'm in a debate, not in a public debate so much, where I will simply say, I have an answer for this, and it's consistent with everything else I believe. It's coherent. But yes, do I wish I had a better answer, a stronger answer? And the answer is yes. I wish I did. There are some really hard sayings in the text. And when I debate publicly, my prayer is, Father, do not let them bring up one of those texts. Now, I have an answer. But you see, it's going to look like, you know, yeah, that's what you've got to say. Because, you know, that's where you are. But nonetheless, I still sense there are many things that I wish I had a better answer for than I do. But I am so confident in the work of the Spirit of God that it does not depend on me to have an answer for a complete answer for everything. What I am called to do as a Christian is to be able to give a reasonable defense of my faith. And so when those questions come, that's what my responsibility is. And I do see through a glass darkly. And now I've known Christ, well, you figure it out, 65. It's been a number of years. We speak with humility, but with confidence that the claim is true. If it has to be an assumed that I think it's true, unless I'm psychotic, Why am I going to be defending something if I don't believe it's true? So there's just an assumption that I believe it's true. I remember speaking to a group, not to be named even location-wise, but in this, I had a Bible study, and if we would have cashed everybody out in that Bible study, we could have paid the national debt. Those are just the kind of people that were there. And I remember the lady saying something that stuck with me. She said, "What amazes me about the way you speak is you just speak with confidence, but not with arrogance." I would to God that that would always be the case, that I could speak with confidence, but not with arrogance. Because arrogance is not becoming to our Lord. It's not even becoming to our message. This requires that we're virtuous in our search for truth. Some of the things that John Lennox said this morning were just so spot on. You know, I think so many of us, even as myself, as preachers, we study the Bible to get something to preach, rather than to study the Bible to get to know God. Virtuous apologetics, in summary, the Bible tells us to walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. When you unpack this verse, you find that there's so much in it. So just for a minute, to the first part, of course, is to walk in wisdom toward outsiders. I take that to mean outside the church. The same thing you get in 1 Peter 3. That is, there's a close connection between our walk and our apologetics. That connection must not be broken. So we walk in wisdom. Do we think about that? How do I live out my life? Do I live out my life before the outsiders in wisdom? Making the best use of our time. That's an interesting thought. Making the best use of my time. Now, we could think of many ways that that would be applicable, but thinking about it in terms of apologetics, the best use of my time. Where do I put my emphasis? Where do I give my time? The best use of my time, I find, comes into play when I'm talking with people, and it is quite obvious that this person is not interested in truth. And so I need to have wisdom to know when I should kind of bring that conversation to a close in a kind and gentle way and move on. Also to know, there was an old commercial some years ago, "Know when to say when." That's a pretty important notion in apologetics. When do you know that it's time just to stop talking? I was speaking to a philosophy professor. She taught epistemology in a university in somewhere in Eastern Europe. And she came to me and she said, I've read your book on epistemology and I would like to talk to you about that. And I said, well, yeah, we can talk about that. And so as we were talking, there's a group, you know how that happens, right? You start talking, the crowd starts to gather around. They start gathering around. And so she got this conversation going, and I'm thinking, where are we going with this? And I then asked her a question. I said, now, you're a professor of epistemology, but you're an atheist. Is that correct? She said, yes, I'm an atheist. So I said, I really have an interest. I'm interested. What do you tell your students about death? I thought that would be interesting. If you're going to teach philosophy, you have to teach something about it. Oh, well, she said, it's quite simple. I just tell them that Live a good life. Live a right kind of a life. And when you die, you just feel fulfilled and you won't care that the curtain is drawn and it's nothing. I said, well, that's interesting. Now I said, but here I'm kind of mystified. Tell me something. What is the good life? What does it mean to do what is right? Are you the one that determines what should be right? And she said this to me. She said, you are trying to trick me. Well, no, I really wasn't. Well, maybe I was. But she had made a claim that she couldn't answer that well, given the framework out of which she was working. Now, I just believed at that moment the best thing that I could do. I mean, here are these, some of her students were around us. I didn't want to embarrass her. She already had got the point. And I said, why don't we go get a bite to eat? I just think there's wisdom in knowing when to say when. Now, maybe I don't always get it right, all right? Maybe sometimes I push longer than I should. Maybe sometimes I give up sooner than I should. But just to realize I need to be sensitive to that and thinking to myself, you know, Bruce, when should I not force this any further? Maybe the best thing for me to do is to step back and let this person think on this a little bit. And then let my speech always be gracious. Again, there's this idea that Christians are not gracious in our speech is all too common of an accusation against us. I'm not saying that's necessarily true of any of you, but I am saying this, as I said, it's maybe a word of caution that we see this, because I see a generation in you. When I came to Christ, I don't know, there were many people talking about apologetics. Again, that's 1965. Yes, the earth's crust had just hardened, but not many people were talking about apologetics. Now, all of a sudden, as Os Guinness says in one of his latest books, everybody thinks they're an apologist. But my encouragement is to be at ELF or teaching and listening to the kind of questions people, young people like yourselves, are asking. I didn't even know those questions existed, let alone what might the answer be. I didn't even know that there were questions out there like that. I just knew that day that I was a sinner and I need to come to Jesus, and that was the only way of salvation. And then from that, the next step was everybody else had to have the same thing, and so I was busy about that. And then I began to realize that as time went on, Christianity was fast losing presumption. I grew up, came into the faith when Christianity, at least in America, still had the presumption. That is, thinking of legal terms, they had presumption in the sense that Christianity was assumed to be the true belief, and anybody wanted to have a contrary belief had to make their case. And so Christians got extremely lazy. And it was just quite easy for you to speak to somebody. And nobody would push back hard at you. I think it's interesting that I was doing some work for a master's thesis that I was finishing, and I had just decided, well, is it true that that things have really moved morally in the Western world, or do we just make that up? Do we just, we hear more about it, but really things are about the same. So I began by doing research, and I only used the magazines, periodicals like Life, Time, U.S. News, World Report. In those days, they had a section, cinema, religion, and everything. So I just said, well, what's being reported? And I started at 1960, and I went through for 30 years to 1990. Could I discern a shift in what these magazines were saying? And I ran across this article, and I think it was written, I think the volume was in somewhere in the late 1960s. And it was about a court case in one of the Eastern Seaboard states in America. And it had to do with an adoption. And the story was about the family that wanted to adopt the child. And in those days, you went through the court system. And this family, they were denied adoption rights. And the reason for that was that they had put on their application that they were atheist. Now, if you don't think there's been a shift in cultural thinking from that time to now, it's absolutely... So when I say we had the presumption and we didn't take advantage, we just assumed. It's like the preacher who preaches, and as long as he says what everybody else believes, they're going to say amen. Not because he built a good argument, but they believed it before they came. And now we've lost the presumption, and we feel often defensive. I would even say some Christians even feel angry. And that all tends to tumble out when we're engaging the unbeliever. And yet this text says that we ought to be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer each person. I do take that quite literally, each person. No two people are the same. We have a large store chain that sells clothing, among other things. And they often, at Christmas time, they advertise that if you can buy, they have this product. And it is this, it's a sock. And the marvelous thing about this sock is that one size fits all. Now, if you bought that sock, I could guarantee you, you would be one of the very few that the sock actually fit. Because most of you would end up with a bunch at the end of the toe, making it very difficult to walk in a shoe. Or you couldn't get the top of the sock over your heel. The truth of the matter is, there isn't any one size that fits all. There's no one methodology that maps on to every situation. If we claim that people are made in the image of God, but then treat them as if they're all the same, we do a disservice to our own claims. Every individual, how do I answer this person? How do I answer that person? Well, before I can answer that person, I must find out what kind of questions that person has. How do I find that out? Well, I find that out by being in conversation and asking questions. Now, when I lecture in universities, I won't say around the world, but in many places, and when I lecture in certain parts of the globe, I have a pretty good idea that the large percentage of the audience would be either unbelievers or just outright atheists. There'd be two different kinds. And so I shape my lecture with that in mind, all right? Now that's a general thing. But if you find yourself in conversation with this person or that person, and that person says, that person's a Jehovah's Witness. I know how to witness to them. I know what they believe. Oh, do you really? No, you don't. You might be generally right. I find it offensive when people tell me what I believe because I'm a Christian. I don't know. How do they know what I believe? They don't know until they get in conversation. So this idea that it's each person I must be engaged, and most of us will be engaged, I don't want to say just strictly person to person, but most of us are going to work in small groups. Most of us are going to have opportunity, whether you have a gathering at your church or whatever, and 20, 25 people come, you will have an opportunity, if they are if you have unbelievers there, I'd assume that would be the purpose of the meeting, and you begin to, you will go around and begin talking with this person and that person, because they are individuals. One thing that I, among many things, I learned from Francis Schaeffer. Now, he's not, I never knew Schaeffer. I heard him 3 weeks before he died. But Francis Schaeffer had a profound impact on my life as a Christian. But one thing I've learned from Schaeffer was he said that in many different ways he said this, but this is the substance of what he said. When you are witnessing to somebody, first see a human person and then a sinner. We are, it's not denying that they may not be a Christian. It's not denying they may be sinners. It's just, if you figure out how we go at this, it will really reshape how you go at the business of engaging the unbeliever. I have a person in front of me. Now, I say more about that in something later on this afternoon, so I don't want to destroy all of that. But for those of you who won't be there anyway, we have done a great, just to say, we have a great disservice. Now, this is opinion, all right? I think we've done a great disservice to the Christian community, raised serious questions by carving up our societies into millennials, X generations, etc. Because when we are now witnessing, we begin to think, oh, this person between this age and that age, this is how I'm going to approach them. And I'm thinking, no, now you see, you got it backwards. You've got to see first a human being. Granted, maybe millennials have different ideas, etc. That's fine. That's secondary. You never understand diversity until you first got it straight about unity. Now, we had that woven into our political documents in America because we believe that all men are created equal. There was the unity. But then we believed that we had to be concerned about the common good, so that always kept diversity within its boundaries. That is the common good, the general welfare. We speak to individuals, and it's what we have in common. Paul says on Mars Hill, about the end of Mars Hill, at the beginning of Mars Hill, how many different kinds, what two ideas are prominent on Mars Hill? Well, the Stoics and the Epicureans. There jolly well could have been many more than that. But you don't hear Paul saying, now I'm going to speak to you over here because, you know, you're Epicurean and you won't quite understand the message. I've got to speak over here. One message. And he says in Acts 17:29, we are all of one blood. What we want to find is, what do we have in common? What I have in common with every human being, whether I like them or I don't, whether their activities are morally offensive to me or not, what we do know, that it's a human being. And there's something special about a human being, and therefore demands something out of me as one who claims part of my belief system that they're made in the image of God. Oh, there's the Acts text. Our tone and language must match our message. Our message is about the truth of things, and this includes humanity. Schaeffer, we used to say that he thought that evangelicals had missed a great opportunity here. That is, that we could explain and act towards and react to individual beings because we had the right view of humanity. And we tend, as Christians, to focus on what we have as differences. You're a believer, I'm an unbeliever, I'm a believer. Now, of course, that's all true. That's all true. But what do we bring to the conversation? Civil in tone for the sake of humanity. Speak with respect, not an argumentativeness. Humble in claim for the sake of truth. Speak with confidence, but not arrogance. Arrogance betrays our own claim to believe. Yeah. Beth is here, and I'm aware of how Jay goes down to the speaker's corner and all. But let me just say this. How do we avoid what the Bible tells us? That we are to be gracious in our speech. Now, we might be more forceful at some points, because if we're not, it might appear in some cultures that what we have to say is not of great weight. But I still think we are commanded by God to be gracious in our speech. Now, there may be, that may work out on a spectrum, okay, where you may want to be in one case, one cultural situation, where you might be a more direct, as a northerner, that is, in the States, people think I'm quite direct. But I try to be gracious. I can be direct and still be very gracious. Gracious to the humanity in the person to whom I'm speaking. Now, there may be people who have have different views on this, and that's understandable, but that would be my defense of my position. But the grace is understanding that's another human being, and I'm not to violate that other being. I have to respect something about the image. But that doesn't mean that I'm, as we say in America, milquetoast. You know, I say, oh gosh, I don't know if I could say this or not. You know, gee, I'm so sorry. No, I don't think that. That doesn't get us anywhere. But there is a straightforwardness that with which we can speak. But I also think the text would call us to be gracious. And it says that in a couple of places. But, and I know a lot is made out of cultural differences. But we must find a way where that is not driving the conversation all the time. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, the Jew first and also to the Greek. So we don't, it's not something I toss out. I do have to take it into account, but I'm not sure it should be the guiding element, because I want this person to witness the love of Christ in the way that I'm communicating with them, and maybe their culture has needs a little bit of Christianity in it to bring it back in line. Civility is absolutely at the bottom of humanity. And when that doesn't persist, there's great danger. Yeah, absolutely. Again, I put these things forward because I'm speaking in general. But I can't speak in general, so to speak, when it comes to the Bible. So the Bible does tell us to be gracious. But what we end up doing is interpreting that the way the word is used today, as opposed to understanding it within a biblical context. So maybe sometime, for you, not me, that you have to look at David in the face and say, graciously, thou art the man. You have no choice. But if we're doing that with anger or defensiveness, then we have betrayed our own position. So let me put it on that side of things, that we're not responding in anger or responding in kind. We are told to turn the other cheek, in a sense. And Lewis has this marvelous, you remember that there's the ghost and the spirit. And the ghost has come up on the train from hell, and they get a chance to look at heaven, and the ghost engages the spirit, and the spirit is the Christian. And so there's a conversation goes on. And one does indeed. I also had to recover from that. Now this is the spirit speaking. And because the ghost says he was an artist, and he said, "Oh, you haven't seen my latest work." And so the spirit is saying, "Yeah, I know that happens, but I had that problem as well. Always a snare, ink in catgut, and paint when necessary down there, but they are also dangerous stimulants. Every poet and musician and artist, but for grace, is drawn away from the love of the thing he tells to the love of the telling." A caution to a young apologist. We can get so infatuated with our ability to argue that we're more happy we just focus on the argument. Preachers can do the same thing. He said, "Till down deep in hell, they cannot be interested in God at all, but only in what they say about him." That is really, I think that was something that John Lennox spoke to either yesterday or maybe in the meeting we had. I don't want to be there, but I will confess, I've been there. Because I found it so easy, you could just put people down. And then I really got to enjoy that. You'd almost get a high. You could see how easily you could push people around. "For it doesn't stop at being interested in paint, you know. They sink lower and become interested in their own personalities and then in nothing but their own reputations." And that is a danger for us as apologists, philosophers. I've warned my young students, if you're going to go out and use this information to push people around, you do it in the name of Jesus, but you just like pushing people around, please forget everything I've told you, because that's not what it's about. If we don't have a deep love for truth and a love for humanity, we run the danger of ending up, "Oh, I want to build up my reputation. I'm a great debater. Build up, boy, when people hear my name, what do they think? Oh, we can debate the atheist." Or this one, which comes up a little bit later, next page, I think. He said, "There have been men before and now who got so interested in proving the existence of God that they came to care nothing for God himself." Beware. That the heart not trick you or me into thinking that because we're successful that we're on God's side. That being a good debater or a good apologist means I love God. I'm not saying it doesn't. But there lies a danger. Those of you who have read Augustine. Augustine said when he was talking about music. And he said, if the singing is more important to me than the one of whom I am singing, then he says, I have sinned. And I would say the same thing for apologists. When I'm that concerned, and it's that animal inside all of us that isn't put down easily, and never think that it won't raise its head, because it will. When you start getting invited, and they want you to come over here, and this university wants you to come and speak, and listen, I will tell you that social media has created a strong narcissistic complex in all of us, and so it's just one more thing. So he said, there have been some who are so occupied in spreading Christianity that they never gave a thought to Christ, man. You see it in smaller matters. Did you ever know a lover of books that with all his first editions and signed copies had lost the power to read them? Or an organizer of charities that had lost all love for the poor? It's the subtlest of all snares. Wow. And what really amazes me is it comes from the pen of a C.S. Lewis. And if you have not read the letters of Lewis, you need to. because just reading his books, which are great, but you don't see the heart of the man until you read his letters. And this man was, I would say, he was the epitome of humility and civility, as was, I would say, even Francis Schaeffer. Both of those men seem to offer something to all of us. Well, not saying that it's true of you. I'm just saying, beware. It's kind of like going down the road and you see a road sign, it's got a curve. Beware, because a great temptation for every one of us. I am no less susceptible to it than I was when I was much younger. And that was a long time ago. All right, well, great. Thank you. Good questions.